From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what the pandemic reveals about the crisis in Michigan's public health systems.
I think there's obviously an opportunity to be self-aware about how you treat people who come in for medical services. You also need this other piece, which is to understand the context from which people are coming to you.
Also, vaccine history and how it informs the race to slow COVID.
We're talking about an RNA virus, and that is especially tough to make a vaccine against. Another famous RNA virus is HIV, and we still don't have a vaccine against that.
And we welcome back Detroit native and former Michigan radio host Jen White. She'll talk about finding her voice in a mostly white industry. Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer reset the state's public health discussions this year, declaring racism a public health crisis. This triggered a set of initiatives to help eliminate racial biases in health and safety professions. To talk more about what those might look like and what scale of action might be required to move the needle, we've invited Camille Bucette, director of the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Camille, welcome to Stateside.
It's so great to be here, April. Thank you for having me.
When the governor of a Midwestern state makes a statement like this, did that create any waves in your field? Do you think people outside of Michigan noticed?
You know, people are definitely noticing, and not just because it's Michigan, but because it's really happening, you know, at the gubernatorial level, which is a very huge commitment. So yes, it has definitely been noticed, and I think, and really well received.
When we talk about racism as a public health crisis, what are the parameters that come to your mind?
So, you know, I think there are many ways to think about this, but at the base is the fact that being Black or being Latino or being Native American in some ways disadvantages you in so many different aspects of life. And because of that, you do not have access to proper housing, to income that will allow you to afford places that contribute to greater well-being, access to healthcare, which is the one that, you know, is most obvious. You don't have the benefit of living in a community where perhaps there are lots of different opportunities for exercise and for communing with, you know, people of all different walks of life. So in some ways, being discriminated against in the way that it is done here in this country puts you behind in so many different dimensions of life that have direct impact on your well-being and particularly your health well-being.
What do you consider the most serious effects of how racism and implicit bias are affecting public health? What measures are you looking at?
So I would say the most direct effect, and you know, this is very literally about health, right, has to do with the ways in which Blacks, Native Americans, Latinos are treated when they come to a healthcare site. And there's a lot of data that's been collected over a number of years, many, many panel studies that really indicate that the treatment is very different. It's different in terms of the actual initial encounter. It's different in terms of the kinds of advice and, you know, therapy and other sort of interactions that a person will have with a healthcare provider. It's different in terms of the follow-up. It's different in terms of the outcome. You see that in a lot of pain research. Most recently, there have been some very interesting studies that have shown that Blacks in particular have very poor pain outcomes, pain management outcomes, simply because we have internalized in the medical profession here in the U.S. that Blacks don't feel pain as much as white people do, for instance. There was recently a study that was just released that showed that children for a whole host of non-catastrophic surgeries, that children of color actually have a much higher mortality rate for the same types of surgeries, like an appendectomy or orthopedic surgery or something like that, than do white children who have had similar procedures. So those are some of the things that we look at.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that Governor Whitmer has proposed. She's committed to a Black Leadership Advisory Council and for implicit bias training for all employees under her leadership. Do those sound like appropriate first steps to you?
They do. You have to start somewhere. And I think she has been, taking a great leadership role in starting there. And I would say that having the Leadership Advisory Council is important because what she's doing is she is raising voices to a level where they can have impact on policy. And that's important because often you don't see that. And then secondly, the training, the implicit bias training is, of course, important. And, every state institution should embrace that, particularly now that we are in the middle of a national conversation. But that's a very important place to start as well.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that. But, you've written about the fact that this problem is not new. It has been identified at even as high as the federal level before. What comes to your mind when we talk about public policy initiatives that, clearly have been discussed in the past that might have some impact in moving the needle, things that would, that might, combine with state and local efforts to really make a difference?
So, one way I think about that particular question is more in terms of how do we frame the questions rather than the particular solutions. And the reason I'm saying that, April, is that sometimes the solutions have to be very location specific, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes, there has to be an overarching set of solutions that will be helpful for everyone. So, for instance, in the overarching category, how we treat young Black boys in preschool and shuttle them off in what has been known as the school to prison pipeline, but shuttle them off down a disciplinary pathway that eventually gets them to be interacting with the justice system and law enforcement, et cetera. So that you would want to get overarching policy solutions for a system like that, which is obviously nationwide, even though the application of that might start, in preschool. But there are going to be other solutions where it is very location specific. So when I think about how you frame problems, I think this is where it's important to have that advisory council because, for instance, one of the ways we often think about things like unemployment and income is people who are unemployed, they need to up their game in terms of their skill set, that they need to be more willing to take jobs that are further away. But we may want to frame it now that we are thinking about race and equity and racial justice. We may want to frame that in terms of what are the barriers that are not self-made that we have to address in order to make it easier for somebody who is very ambitious to be able to get a job that is commensurate with his or her skill set. So I think that framing piece is very, very important and actually probably more important than looking across at other locations for solutions that may have worked in that particular locale.
Camille, I think a lot of Michiganders were very aware that the governor was pointing to real-time examples from the pandemic when she made this announcement. I think many people also wondered how much can be done during this moment, a generational sort of triple crisis for the healthcare system, the economy, and just the moment of institutional crisis that's happening because those factors combine. Is this the right time to make it a starting point for deep systemic change?
I think it is. For a number of reasons. And, governors have a good way of being able to understand the public mood and the public moment. And, so I think they have an intuition that actually serves them well. So I would say that this is a good moment to start that conversation. But in order to actually have long-term impact, you have to put into place a number of things that make that work sustainable over time. Because, as you just mentioned, a lot of these problems are, decades, if not longer, in the making. And so one of the things I would say about where Governor Whitmer has started is that I think it's a great starting point, but I would add to what she has done, that when she works with her advisory council and when she works across the state agencies, that she develop a set of goals that can be measured, for which there is going to be data collected and for which there is an end point. So, a goal could be, we are going to reduce maternal mortality among Black women in the next 3 years by 25%. That's a goal and it's measurable, right? So you need to have several things like that. And the timeline needs to be, fairly short. So we have to follow the political calendar. Political calendars tend to be pretty short. And I would say you're talking about a 2 to 3 year period. To that, I would add that we have to know who's accountable for those goals and those metrics. And that's tricky when you're dealing with policy and politicians and a range of equities there. And the last thing I would add is that, when we talk about racism being a public health crisis, we're not just talking about health. And if you've noticed in my answers, I'm not limiting my answers to health. That's because health is now considered, health and well-being is considered to be the outcome of a range of social determinants. So when the governor is talking about wanting to address this public health crisis, she will need to do that across a variety of different agencies and across a variety of different kinds of partners. So when you think about housing, you think about the built environment, you think about, how much money people have to live on. You think about the ways in which education does or does not serve the entire population of Michigan. These are just some examples of how interlinked those particular areas are with health outcomes.
Camille Bucette directs the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Camille, it's a pleasure talking to you.
It's been great, April. Thank you so much.
Coming up, the race for the COVID vaccine and why who makes it matters.
I am concerned that a vaccine might be rushed to the marketplace with the very name of the project, Warp Speed. I mean, it's probably never a good idea to name your vaccine project after something from Star Trek.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Does anyone else ever catch themselves imagining what things will be like, quote, when this is all over and we finally have a vaccine? It's a pretty bright and shiny prospect, and for good reason. This has been an immensely difficult time for so many people within Michigan's communities. But what is the process of making a vaccine, and what happens when it's finished? We're checking in today with Dr. Howard Markell, medical historian at the University of Michigan, to learn about the history of vaccine development and what a COVID vaccine will and won't mean when it's finally ready. Howard, welcome back.
Nice to be here, April.
Before we dive in on the history end of things, could you walk us through what the basic steps of the vaccine-making process look like today?
Well, every vaccine is different, and it depends on whether it's a vaccine against a bacteria or a virus. Let's take, for example, the polio vaccine, which was announced to be effective here at the University of Michigan on April 12, 1955. Jonas Salk used a method for that vaccine of taking, there were three strains of polio, took those strains of polio and inactivated or killed those viral strains in formaldehyde and then made a vaccine out of it. So that's a killed virus vaccine. Mm-hmm. And then there are live attenuated viral vaccines where you take the virus and put it through generation after generation until it loses its ability to cause disease. But if injected into, say, a human being, it will still create an antibody response and an immune response to it. And that's what the Sabin oral vaccine for polio did that many of us took In fact, I remember taking mine at the age of three and thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread because it was on a sugar cube. I thought every vaccine should be like that.
Right.
In the case of COVID, we're talking about an RNA virus, and that is especially tough to make a vaccine against. Another famous RNA virus is HIV, and we still don't have a vaccine against that. So they are probably taking little pieces of the genome of the RNA virus of COVID. That's what they're doing right now. And using the pieces that cause the best antibody and T cell response to it. So they have to do that, then they have to test it. There are several phases for the testing to make sure it is safe. Right now, there are two vaccines that are in their phase three test on about 30,000 people per vaccine. Some of those people will get a placebo or a blank vaccine, or maybe even a vaccine to another virus, and the other a certain amount will get the actual vaccine. That's called a blinded, hopefully a double-blinded random trial, and then they'll go on and test that once again. But, you know, after that, there are licensing things that you must do. There are manufacturing things that must be accomplished. And you have to make, in this case, over 300 million doses just for Americans. And that's hoping that there's only one dose that's needed. It might be a double dose type vaccine. So there's a lot of time, work, and effort that is ahead of us for a COVID vaccine.
I always wondered, when we talk about the costs of developing a vaccine, which part is really responsible for the high cost? Is it the research and development or more the trial phase of development?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly R&D costs a fortune because you're hiring really good scientists to come up from scratch, you know, for a new recipe for a new vaccine. And this is a new virus because it's never been before dealt with by human beings. Unlike the flu vaccine, for example, a new strain might come up, but we already know how to make it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the testing is extremely expensive because that has to be done perfectly or as close to perfectly as possible. And the manufacturing process can be very expensive as well. So all in all, it's truly a fortune. And that's why vaccines can cost so much, like the HPV vaccine that's developed against human papillomavirus costs several hundred dollars per dose. And the reason is that there's so much already paid for by the company that makes it, both in R&D and testing it. So it's everything.
All of the above.
All of the above.
So what are the lessons about vaccine development that you take away from, say, the polio vaccine or some of the other processes in American history?
Well, you don't want to cut corners, and you want to be very careful at every step of the way in testing and developing it. You know, the polio vaccine, the Salk vaccine was ready in 1954. And then it was handed over to Thomas Francis, who was a professor of epidemiology here at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He was also an expert at vaccine trials and influenza vaccines in particular. And so over a year, he recruited some 1.8 million children. And about 600,000 of them got the real shot, and the rest got a placebo. And he used children of different ages, different grades in school, and so on, to meticulously test this vaccine so he could announce on April 12, 1955, that it was safe, potent, and effective. Well, parents back then were so scared of the risk of polio that they pushed their kids to the head of the line to be in the test, not the actual vaccine, but the test. Can you imagine that happening today?
Not and with COVID.
Not for COVID, right. And then once it was announced that it was effective, about a week into it, hundreds of thousands of batches made by the Cutter Laboratories Incorporated turned out to have a live polio strain in their vaccine. Ugh. And thousands of kids got polio, and a couple of hundred were left with paralysis, and 10 actually died. But what's remarkable about that incident is that it was announced, it was fixed, and it turned out to be just a blip on the horizon because parents still went and waited in line to get their kids vaccinated against polio. If that happened today, that would be the end of that particular vaccine, and it surely would not help the vaccination of children in general.
What kinds of regulations are in place now for making something like that less likely to happen these days? I'm sure everyone who's thinking or hearing about clinical trials would like to know.
Well, there are a whole slew of regulations that the FDA requires before they will approve a vaccine. And a lot has to do with how effective is it, for example. You know, most vaccines are none are 100% effective. But if you could get a vaccine that's 90-odd% effective, that's cause for joy. Some are only 50 to 70% effective, and that's maybe what we see with this one. They'll also be testing the purity, the way it's made. Is it a killed virus or a live attenuated virus? What are the processes when you make a live attenuated virus to prevent it from going live and bad? And also the various agents you use for preserving that. You might remember a while ago, a very common vaccine preservative was called thimerosal, which contains mercury. And while that wasn't found to cause problems in terms of the mercury itself, a lot of people objected to their children being injected with a mercurial agent, and so that was removed as a preservative. So those kinds of things are all part of the licensing process. You also have scientists at the FDA looking and scrutinizing the testing process to make sure that what the vaccine people say is actually true.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the University of Michigan's Dr. Howard Markel about the history of vaccine development. Howard, you kind of alluded to this, but there was a time when the government or research institutions were much more deeply involved in making vaccines. We're in a market now where pharmaceutical companies are really the main engine of that. Do you think there is a case to be made for the balance shifting back the other way?
Yeah, I've long actually advocated that, and you're absolutely right. For a long time, government in the form of, say, municipal health departments or state health departments made vaccines. And, for example, in the state of Michigan, the public health department used to make vaccines all the time. And the city of New York used to make vaccines and even had a stable of horses where they made diphtheria antitoxin by injecting diphtheria into horses and then drawing off blood and spitting off the serum. By the 70s, a lot of governments stopped making vaccines, and various drug companies or pharmaceuticals made them, but they found the liability issue a little bit too risky. Even though there is now a federal law, the Vaccine Act of 1975, to prevent or limit the liability, very few pharmaceutical companies want to get involved, particularly in diseases where there's not a big market. So, for example, you would not find an American company likely to take on a dengue fever vaccine or a Zika virus vaccine because they wouldn't make any money out of it. So there's actually very few companies who make this nowadays. And I would wholeheartedly agree that the United States government ought to take this over and have its own vaccine producing facility.
I mean, can you think of any way to overcome some of the liability issues that stand in the way?
Well, the best way is to make a pure and effective vaccine. But in the end, these are biological agents, and there is a chance, very small and remote, that something might go wrong. You know, most of the vaccine suits have not been successful because they could not link the actual vaccine to the cause of a particular disease. And there are, of course, federal laws that limit the liability of what somebody can sue a company for. But the best way is to make a good vaccine, but we all are taking a tiny risk when we roll up our sleeves. And what we need to do is weigh the risk and the benefits. The risk of getting COVID and getting sick or getting one of your loved ones sick is far greater, I hope, than the effective vaccine that we will develop that's thoroughly tested and thoroughly vetted and thoroughly licensed.
So what are some of the specific challenges that you see scientists facing as they try to work on the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, it's a tough virus in many respects. It's very stealthy, but there are some very promising vaccine trials going on. I really see the biggest risk is not so much of the scientists who are working on vaccines, both at the Moderna company and at the Oxford University group, as well as, you know, dozens of others, but the social or political aspects of it. So I am concerned that a vaccine might be rushed to the marketplace, you know, with the very name of the project, Warp Speed. I mean, it's probably never a good idea to name your vaccine project after something from Star Trek, but you know that it might be.
Are you referring to Project Warp Speed, I assume?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, Warp Speed. So I do worry about, you know, it being rushed to the marketplace as a sort of October surprise. And, you know, a lot of Americans are too. We already have many, many people who are anti-vaccination in general before COVID ever developed. The anti-COVID people are joined by the libertarians and several other people who find this or believe this to be a false entity that the government is just using to take control of the American people, and other conspiracy theories that are simply not true. And, you know, I was reading the other day, it was in the New York Times, a report of interviews among the African-American community who feared a government-sponsored vaccine, particularly one that was endorsed by President Trump, and were hearkening that back to the Tuskegee syphilis study. Well, you can't think of a worse group to opt out than the African-American community, because they have been so heavily challenged by COVID thus far during this pandemic. And yet their reasons for being upset about it or concerned about it vis-a-vis the Tuskegee syphilis study are not imaginary. So we have a lot of public relations to be doing.
Yeah. Let's say, let's hope that we get to a safe and effective vaccine relatively soon. What do you project about who's going to get it and how it'll be distributed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there are two contracts, one with Pfizer and one with Johnson & Johnson, each to make about 100 million lots of vaccine. Now, this is assuming it's a one-time vaccine, not a vaccine that you take, say, in January, and then have to take a booster in June. So I don't know that. But that's already 200 million lots, and we have about 350 million Americans. And a lot of bioethicists have been arguing or debating who should go first. Should it be elderly people? Should it be the people who are at greatest risk because of other health conditions that they might have? Should it be the young people who might be asymptomatic carriers? And that all needs to be sorted out. And what my hope is that we'll be creating enough vaccine for those who want it to get it. You know, there's a very cautionary tale here. In 2009, when we were experiencing the H1N1 influenza pandemic, in late April, early May, when it was particularly new and scary, if you asked 100 Americans who wanted a flu vaccine for H1N1 that year, about 90 would raise their hands and say yes. Once the H1N1 vaccine was ready in the fall of 2009, only 20% of Americans got it. There was plenty for all, but only 20% actually went to their doctors, rolled up their sleeves and took the shot. Fewer than 5% of the African American community and the Latinx community volunteered to get the vaccine. So that's an interesting figure too. And that is not surprising. We see this with flu vaccine all the time. So I do worry by the time there is a COVID vaccine, not everybody will get it.
Presumably, some of it is simple access to healthcare.
Yeah, there's access to it. There's cost, although the United States government says it will bear the cost of it. There's waiting in line for it. You might just get tired of it. And then there's also who might have COVID fatigue and just say, forget it. It's hard to imagine. And this is a perverse thing to say, but I hope we're turning people away for a while, because that means more people want the vaccine than we have it, and then we'll make more. Generally, with these kinds of things, we have a lot more on hand than those who want it.
Dr. Howard Markell is a medical historian with the University of Michigan. Howard, always nice to talk to you, and thanks for giving us something to hope for in the remaining months of the year.
My pleasure, April. Stay well.
Coming up on the show, Jen White's amazing year. The Detroit native and former Michigan radio host is at the helm as the host of the daily national news show 1A. We'll catch up with her after a break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We just about lost our minds around here when we heard the news that Jen White, former All Things Considered host for Michigan Radio and, more recently, host of a daily show at Chicago Public Radio, is now the host of 1A, NPR's nationally syndicated daily news program out of WAMU in Washington, D.C. What a time to be doing this work. Global pandemic, economic collapse, logistically challenged national elections. It's just another day at the office for Jen. Now that she's had a few weeks to catch her breath, we are so excited to talk to her. Jen White, welcome back to Stateside.
Hello, April. It's so good to talk to you.
How in the world are you doing?
Oh, wow. It's funny. I ask people that question a lot, and then someone asks me, and I'm like, I don't really know. It's complicated. You know, I'll say that it's complicated. I am healthy, so I count that as a blessing. So my family's healthy. We're all doing well. But we moved to a new city during a pandemic. I'm trying to get to know my new coworkers over Zoom and Slack and all the other tools people are using as folks work from home right now. So it's complicated, but I feel like if the most I have to complain about right now is adjusting to a new job and adjusting to a new city, I really don't have much to complain about.
Has your process for how you're going about your daily work changed?
In a way. So one of the things that shifted is just the structure of my day. My show in Chicago was from 11 to 1. So my day just starts a little earlier now, too. And because 1A is a show where we're often covering one topic over the course of an hour, trying to get into the fine details of an issue is really important. So, yeah, I'm spending a lot of time reading and just trying to understand all of the nuance, because, as you know, once you open the microphone, you don't really know where the conversation is going to go, even though you may be as well prepared as you can be. So you have to be able to make the zigs and zags as they come at you.
Yeah. And one of the challenges in daily news at any level is trying to keep up with what's going on. And it can happen that interviews lose their conversationality, I guess, and become more of a recitation. What's your method for pushing back against that and bringing your subjects back into the moment with you?
The key thing I use is listening. I really make it a point to listen intently to the conversation that is happening, not the conversation we had planned. Because if you aren't listening to the conversation that's happening in front of you, you miss out on those opportunities to hook into a moment of discovery or surprise or delight or just something unexpected. And I think if I'm only just reading the questions we had planned for that conversation, you miss out on all of that. And I also don't think it's really of service to the listener, because they're listening too. And I really see myself as an advocate for people who are listening to the show. And so if something a guest says sparks an additional question in their mind, then I want to ask that question.
You're dealing with so many issues that have about a million different dimensions to them. The pandemic and the economic situation, the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, these are not like one conversation subjects. How do you go about trying to figure out what it is that you have to bring to each of these subjects? You know, as obviously there's a lot of discussion about, you know, before an interview gets booked, but is there something that you use in the moment to try to intuit what listeners need to know about these incredible, you know, maybe once in a 100-year type issues?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think a lot of it comes out of the production process. So, you know, we do editorial meetings every single day on this show. And in those meetings, we, as a pretty diverse group of producers, you know, and we, our executive producer and me as the host, trying to talk through the different iterations of a conversation and trying to make it broad enough that people who are listening are engaged and feel like there's something they can hook into, but also trying to keep those conversations focused so it doesn't get overwhelming, because you can try to do too much. I mean, you can really try to do too much. It's like, mm-hmm. we've got an hour to fill. We're going to talk about all the things. Well, you can't give all the things justice, even in an hour. And so it's at once trying to suss out the nuance in a conversation, but then trying to hone in on the parts that are the most important, that are the most essential in that moment, and then always remembering that you have another show the next day and the next week and the next month. So just because you have a conversation that day doesn't mean that's where the conversation ends. You can return to this subject another time and say, hey, we had this conversation a week ago about this thing, but here are some questions that still need to be answered, so we're going to talk about that today.
Right. For those who don't know you as well, will you talk a little bit about how you first became attracted to journalism and how you found yourself in broadcasting?
Hey, so I fell in love with radio as a medium when I was a little kid. My dad had these tapes of old radio dramas, The Lone Ranger and things like that. And I would sit in our living room and listen to those tapes when I was a kid, and fell in love with the human voice and the power of storytelling. In 99, that's when I got my first job at Michigan Radio, and I actually came in as a fundraiser. I saw this job posting for a major gifts officer at Michigan Radio, and I so wanted to work in public radio. My sister had introduced me to it when I was 16 through Car Talk. She was like, there's this show you got to hear, these crazy guys. So that's where my public radio listening started. And so when I saw the post, I was like, oh, they are probably not going to hire me, but I'm going to try anyway. And they did. And so over the course of my, gosh, was it 16 years, I think I was at Michigan Radio, I did so many things, major gifts. I ran the television station, the public television station for a while. But over the course of that time, I was learning. I was learning from my colleagues. I was learning, you know, how a radio documentary gets put together. I was learning interview skills. I was learning all of that as I went, because I knew where my heart was. And my heart was in front of the mic. That's where I wanted to be. And then Charity Nebbe, who was the All Things Considered host before me, when she decided to move back to Iowa, she really encouraged me to apply for that position. She said, you're ready for it. You should do it. And I was like, Charity, I don't know. And she said, just try. Try. You've been subbing for me. Like, you're trained. You know how to do the shift. You know how to do this. You're a good interviewer. Like, go for it. And I did. And I got the job. And I never looked back.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jen White, formerly All Things Considered host on Michigan Radio. You hear her today hosting the daily national news program 1A from WAMU and NPR in Washington. I'm thinking back in my head now. You started in 1999. Mm-hmm. That was a time at which, you know, public radio was a very different kind of business than it is today. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who were in at that time had gotten into it as a form of alternative journalism, or at least as a, you know, sort of an adjunct to mainstream media. But everything is different now. The business is so much more tooled toward breaking news. And you as a host have handled so many more breaking news topics and a much more global perspective. How are you feeling about where public media is right now and just how the job has changed and how listeners, what listeners want of you has changed?
That's a really interesting question because now that I'm here in D.C., this is my third public radio station, and I think about the way things have been different and how they've stayed the same. Here's what I can say is the same. I think the people who listen to public radio still want to hear their communities reflected in the stories we tell. What I think is different is that it does feel like we're in a bit more of a pressure cooker nowadays. And because there is this avalanche of information through social media, there's at once a desire to be in front of the news, but we also have to be really careful that being in front of the news doesn't mean we're doing that at the expense of getting the story right. But it feels like that pressure has increased over time.
The other thing that strikes me about the arc of your work life is here you are on the job in your prime at a time when so many news organizations are having a reckoning over the experiences of people of color and women and LGBTQ folks and other marginalized communities. I mean, on the surface, these are workplace issues for journalists. You know, how do people feel in traditionally white journalism spaces and public media spaces? But these discussions have huge implications for whose stories get told and just how listeners come to understand stories about race and gender. We should say these conversations have definitely happened at Michigan Radio. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you came to WAMU at a time of huge upheaval that led to the exit of the general manager. When you think about this moment in journalism and the voices that are coming to the center, do you think that meaningful change is happening in front of us right now?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, so like I said, I've been in public media now for 20 plus years, and none of these conversations are new. None of these conversations are new. I had these conversations at Michigan Radio. We had these conversations at WBEZ. We're having them here at WAMU. And as my mom would say, the proof is in the pudding. We won't know whether or not a shift has taken place until we're on the other side of it. My hope is that this will be a moment when we all, our entire profession, feels galvanized to pay close attention to who we're bringing into our organizations, why we're bringing them in. Is it just because we want them to tell stories about race and gender and LGBTQI issues, or it's because we value their voices and the perspectives they bring? And then how do we create an environment where they stay? Because one of the really troubling things I've seen over the course of my career are the number of young journalists from marginalized groups who have come into this industry and then left because they didn't feel welcome, because they didn't feel like they had a place, because they didn't feel valued. So it's not just about bringing people into the door. It's about keeping them in the house. And that is not something we're going to know if we're doing it well for some time. I would be interested to have this conversation in 10 years.
What were some of the things that kept you sticking with it?
The fact that I did have people around me who, both within my organizations and outside of my organizations, people who affirmed me, who constantly assured me that I had a voice and I had the right, and in some cases, the responsibility to use my voice. It's not to say that there haven't been times when it was incredibly discouraging or when I've had conversations and I've walked away from those conversations feeling sad or disappointed. Have I experienced microaggressions in the workplace? Absolutely. All of those things have happened. But I always think about my parents and the things they overcame, the sacrifices they were willing to make for us. And so when young journalists came into the organizations I worked in, I wanted somebody to be there who they could connect with. I wanted somebody to be there to advocate for them and to help them learn how to advocate for themselves. I wanted someone to be there who they could look at and say, I see a possibility for what I want to do with my career. And the only way I could do that was if I was still in the room, if I was still in the building.
Right. The fact that you did stay gave you, put you in a position to do some really, really amazing work. You don't have to live in Chicago to have heard Jen White's voice on podcasts like Making Oprah, Making Obama, or 16 Shots. I mean, these were stories that were right at the podcast stories that were right in the center of America's consciousness again and again. What would you say your time in Chicago and dipping into the podcast field a little bit more, what would you say that those experiences did for you as a host?
Oh, wow. I mean, so the first thing they did was just help me to think about audio in a different way. I was so accustomed to doing, you know, the live two-way or the, you know, the interview that ends after 12 minutes. And to have that time to really immerse myself in the making of something that was so sound rich and creative, and kudos to Colin McNulty, the producer, on the making series. It helped me fall back in love with radio. It helped me fall back in love with audio, and sort of, I guess, reaffirmed that early love I found as a child. But then I also know it helped me think more creatively about what we can do in a talk show format. There's so much room for creativity. There's so much room for introducing content to our audiences in new ways, and having them even think differently about the power of this medium.
When we think about what you bring to the microphone, a lot of people talk in the Midwest about how the coastal regions don't understand or don't pay attention to the so-called flyover areas, and they sometimes miss the big stories until they get beaten over the head with them. How would you say your experiences in Michigan and Illinois, how have they helped to inform the journalists that you are today working in D.C.?
You know, I'll point to a story that was still evolving as I was leaving Michigan, and that's the Flint water crisis. Here you have a community that has been so deeply damaged by a failure of government, essentially. That's what it was. In a city that a lot of people weren't even talking about before the water crisis, but that was dealing with disinvestment, that was dealing with issues of race. And had we been having some of the conversations about what was happening in Flint before the water crisis, would we have had a water crisis? If there had been more conversations about why Flint needed investment and how to make that happen and holding public officials accountable to get that done, would the water crisis have happened? People's lives were changed. People's health were damaged. Children were harmed. And we can't pretend as if what happened in Flint isn't playing out in other places across the Midwest. And I think because so much of the news has been focused on either coast, yeah, they may have been happening in local media. I think local media does pay attention to those things largely, but they weren't happening on the scale that they should have happened. And I hope that 1A is a place where we can bring more of those stories to national attention, because it truly is a national conversation we need to be having.
Jen White is the host of 1A out of WAMU in Washington, distributed nationally on NPR for stations like Michigan Radio. Jen, we couldn't be happier for you. And thank you so much for taking a couple minutes to fill us in on how things have been going for you.
My pleasure, April.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.